McMaster House. Monday, March 15. We sit outside the mill in a rare patch of winter sunshine, our feet propped up on a stump. Ephraim usually isn't one to smoke, but ever since Percy returned in good health, he has taken to having an afternoon smoke break. I join him when I can. As for the bird, Ephraim has no plans to rebuild the mews. For now, Percy has been left to flit around the mill and roost where he pleases. I watch my husband produce an old, ornate pipe from his pocket, along with a pouch of tobacco. He lights, puffs, rolls the smoke around his mouth and then out again in a smooth stream. He's not one for smoke rings, given that he isn't a pretentious man, so he doesn't make a show of his good mood. I am reaching for the pipe to practice the technique that Mrs. Ney showed me when I hear the heavy clomp of horse hooves coming down the lane. As I turn, the person I least expect emerges from the wood. Grace Sewell's mother, Mrs. Hendricks. She of the high ideals and sour expression. I've never seen a person look more uneasy on horseback, nor a horse less pleased to be ridden. Her spine is straight, her arms stiff, and her eyes are filled with the kind of terror that any horse could smell. It's a wonder she's made it here alive. Brutus would have thrown her 5 seconds into the ride. Mrs. Hendricks, I greet her with a forced smile. How can I help you today? Her teeth are clenched so tightly she has to stretch her jaw before she can speak. My daughter, Grace, is she unwell? It is the child. She sent me to collect you. You said your daughter called for me. I turn an accusing stare toward Mrs. Hendricks. You lied. Though today marks the Ides of March, it is still bitterly cold. Most years the river has opened by now and the ground is starting to thaw. But not this year. Winter still holds us in its bitter grip. Even though the sun is out and shining, it gives no warmth. I look to it and frown. I am tired of winter, and I am angry at being tricked. If I had told you the truth, you wouldn't have come, she protests. Of course not. I want nothing to do with that man. Well, his wife is going to die if you don't go in. And I will be thrilled to tell the entire town that you left her to do so because of some petty grudge. Petty grudge? 2 women in this town have buried children, and my son is in jail all because of him. Mrs. Hendricks straightens her back, lifts her chin. He is no good at this birthing business, I'll give you that. And I will also concede that, had you not been there, my daughter and grandson would likely be dead. It's a debt I'll owe you for the rest of my life. But his incompetence doesn't mean that another woman and child should be buried. Not if you can help. I take a step back and peer at her suspiciously. What is any of this to you? His wife and my daughter have become friends. Mrs. Hendricks huffs out a sigh. I will be leaving in 2 months. If that girl dies, Grace will have nothing. I would hardly count a husband, a child, a home, and a community as nothing. But I am in no mood to argue with Mrs. Hendricks. Besides, we are standing in the street and could be overheard at any moment. Yet, before I can stop her, she pulls the rope beside the door and bells chime inside the house. Within seconds, I hear the heavy tread of footsteps. Did Paige call for me? No, she admits. And perhaps he will be angry, but I'm sure he wants a dead wife less than he wants your help. That's why I walked across the river and borrowed that demon of a horse from the tavern. Said horse, Beulah, is nearly as old as I am, and whatever teeth she has left are long and yellow. She's as placid a beast as God ever made. Still, neither had seemed pleased with the other's company. And when Mrs. Hendricks slid clumsily off her back, I didn't know who would bite first. I was pleased to see Beulah do the honor. I had believed Mrs. Hendricks at first, had followed her into the hook, where we'd put our horses at the tavern, then walked across the river. Mrs. Hendricks remained quiet most of the way, and I thought nothing of it. Worry does that to a mother. But it wasn't until she walked right past the chandlery and down the street that I began to suspect something was amiss. And when she stopped in front of the old McMaster place, I knew I'd been duped. Like Beulah, I might be getting a little long in the tooth, but I am not so old that I forget basic facts, like Samuel Coleman telling me that Dr. Page has rented the McMaster home. I am just about to turn and walk away when the door is thrown back. This Benjamin Page looks nothing like the arrogant, well-kept physician who has plagued me for months. He is a wreck. Hair sticking on end, sweaty brow, glassy eyes, clothing rumpled. Still, he musters enough animosity to insult me. "What the hell is she doing here?" he demands. If you had asked me in December if there would ever be a scenario in which I would thank the Almighty for Mrs. Hendricks, I would have laughed. And yet, all those months ago, I'd never seen her in her true form, as a Boston matriarch, the sort of woman who can intimidate a Harvard-educated man. That is the version of herself that she presents to the petulant, frightened Dr. Page. "Stand back, young man," she orders, and her voice is so loud and so sure that he stumbles two steps backward into the dark hall. "I called for this woman, and you will do exactly as she says. But I—" "Shut up! Take us to your wife." He is flummoxed, so beside himself that, for once, the man doesn't argue. We follow him down the dark hall, up the dark stairs, into a bedroom so dark that I can barely see the hand in front of my face. "Where is she?" Mrs. Hendricks demands.
"There, on the bed."
I see only a shadow surrounded by other shadows. "Why is it so dark in here?" I ask. Dr. Page snorts.
"Because science has proven that a dark room relaxes the patient. If you knew anything about medicine, you would know..."
A whimper from the bed silences him. "How long since her pains began?"
"Yesterday, early."
"And how long since she was last up and moving?"
"She hasn't been up. She must keep her strength."
If he was closer, I'd slap him. "And since she last ate?" I can see only the outline of his face in the darkness, but I hear the disdain in his voice clearly enough.
"As I'm sure you well know, Mistress Ballard, a full stomach will cause indigestion in a laboring woman. She's eaten nothing since her first pain." Oh, the man's an idiot. That much is clear, and I will not argue with him. "Do you want me here?" I ask.
"No."
"Does your wife want me here?"
"She has no say in the—"
Mrs. Hendricks has finally had enough. She grabs his ear and twists so hard he lets out a howl that would rival that of a dying dog. Dr. Page swats at her hand as she hauls him to his wife's bedside. When she releases him, he plops to the mattress like a marionette that's had its strings cut. Mrs. Hendricks leans over the bed, and I must squint to see her put her palm to the young woman's cheek. "Hello, dear," she says. "We've come to help. Would you like that?" There is a muffled answer that sounds affirmative. "Very good. This woman here is a midwife. Her name is Martha Ballard, and she saved my daughter's life. If you would like, she will help you get this baby into the world." Again, the affirmative.
"Excellent," Mrs. Hendricks says.
Then she turns to Dr. Page and says, "Go find a chair and sit somewhere out of the way. Perhaps you will learn something." I am still standing near the door, medical bag in hand, when she waves me forward.
"Martha, if you don't mind."
I go to the window instead of the bed and throw the curtains open. Afternoon sunlight floods the room, and I can finally see the doctor's wife. She is curled into a ball in the middle of the bed, pale as a ghost, half asleep, sweating.
"Mrs. Hendricks," I ask.
"Yes."
"Can you stay?" I can. Good. The first thing I need you to do is go to the kitchen and get this woman something to eat. How will that help? If she is to deliver a child today, she must wake up. And there are only two things in all of creation that wake a human, sunlight and food. Dr. Page snorts. Oh, that is preposterous. Coffee only increases heart rate, I tell him. But if you have some, by all means go make it. She'll need that too. When Mrs. Hendricks reaches for his ear again, he jumps off the bed and speeds from the room. She follows. Only then do I approach the girl. Hello, Mrs. Page, I say, sitting beside her.
Hello.
She is young, 18 or 19, perhaps, and small-boned, like a girl. It does not surprise me that Page chose a diminutive wife, someone he could intimidate. But that fact will not make my job any easier. If she is as small of hip as she is of shoulder, we might well be in trouble. I am here to help. I have delivered many hundreds of babies. Would you like my assistance in delivering yours? She nods, then groans. Good. But before I can help you, I must ask one thing of you. She looks at me, eyes wide.
What is that?
You must give me your trust.
How do I do that? She asks.
You do everything I say, no matter if it doesn't make sense or if your husband argues with me.
And what do you want me to do?
Only two things for now. Eat what Mrs. Hendricks brings you, and then get up and walk the room. I will help you with every step.
But I'm so tired.
I know. Did your husband give you medicine? Laudanum, perhaps? She nods.
Yesterday?
My guess is that it was a lower dose than he gave Grace. Otherwise, she'd be dead. But I don't dare hope the man has learned anything about messing with the natural order of a birth. It probably hasn't fully worn off. But there is one thing I can promise you. If you stay in this bed, if you eat nothing, you and your child will die. It will be slow and painful. Exhaustion will swallow you both. And there is nothing I will be able to do for you. I grab her hands. But now? Now is not too late. So, will you trust me? It is easy to assume that for a birth to go badly, something specific must go wrong. A breech presentation, a hemorrhage, an infection. I have faced all these difficulties and more. But it is often the mortal threat of exhaustion that can cause a woman's life to ebb away. There is no condition on earth more draining than that of labor, and few ways to rouse a woman once she has succumbed to exhaustion. Mrs. Page listens to me. I watch her think for a moment, and then she nods.
I can do that.
I push her pale blonde hair back from her face. I press my palm to her forehead. She is warm, but not feverish. I have to touch you now, I tell her, to see how far along you are in this labor.
Okay.
But there is something very important I must know before I can do that.
What?
Your name.
Mrs. Page.
No, I tell her. Page is your husband's name. And Mrs. is the thing you became on your wedding day. What is the one you were given at birth?
Melody.
It is very nice to meet you, Melody. My name is Martha, and I will help you through this. Melody Page has to walk the room for 5 grueling hours before she hits transition, and it takes another full hour of pushing before her tiny daughter makes an entrance into the world. Even then, it is 10 o'clock before the work is done, and 11 before I have finally packed my things. Mrs. Hendricks joins me at the bedroom door as I am leaving. I do not like you, she says, apropos of nothing. It makes me laugh. Nor I you. This earns the first real smile I have ever received from the woman. But I do respect you, she tells me, and I am sorry for the trouble I gave you with Grace. That is more than enough for me, I say. Then I look behind her to the bed, where Melody is cradling her little bundle. You will stay with her? Through the night. Thank you. Call for me if you have any concerns.
I will,
she says, then returns to Melody's side without another word. I am turning for the door when Dr. Page calls out,
Mistress Ballard.
A sigh. Yes?
Let me walk you out.
I nod. We walk in silence down the hall, the stairs, and to the first floor. He opens the door and leans against the frame, blocking my exit.
What is your fee?
He asks. I do not want payment.
I cannot allow you to leave here without coin, he says. I refuse to be in your debt.
You have no say in the matter. I will accept nothing from you but an apology.
You are a stubborn old bitch, aren't you?
Suddenly, I find myself missing Mrs. Hendricks. She'd likely rip his ear clean off at those words.
Is that what you really think of me? After today?
I think you are full of yourself, a countrywoman bloated with the idea of your own skill.
I nod sadly. And yet, you still want to pay me.
It is the right thing to do.
Let me ask you a question, I say. He looks at me but doesn't respond. I stick my finger in his face. Have you ever successfully delivered a child?
In medical school, I assisted any number of doctors in... No, that is not what I mean.
On your own?
I don't see how that...
So the answer is no. And the result is two of Hollowell's children deadborn. Such things might not matter at Harvard, but here they matter immensely. Page lifts his chin.
You do understand that they call it the practice of medicine for a reason, don't you? The consequences of such practice can be unfortunate. But no doctor expects less, nor should the citizens of any town.
And yet you are willing to practice on your own wife.
Shame on you.
He says nothing. Here is what I require for a payment. You stick to doctoring. I will do the delivering. His eyes are blank, uncomprehending.
You will never attend another woman in childbirth, not in this town. If you are too arrogant to call for me, then call someone else.
I care not.
But I do not ever want you to set your hand to a laboring woman ever again. Do you understand?
The young Dr. Benjamin Page grows still, then pale. I see his jaw tremble with rage, but he steps aside to let me pass, and before he closes the door, he nods, just once, and that is enough.
Dr. Coleman's store. The ice is thickest in the shallows near the riverbank. Toward the center of the Kennebec, however, it creaks beneath my feet, like old floorboards, like old bones, and even though I know it will bear my weight, I proceed carefully, medical bag in one hand and the other outstretched, each footstep purposeful, listening for popping sounds, feeling for shifting and sinking beneath my feet. Sam Dalwin is not the only man to have fallen through the ice, though he is one of only a handful to survive. The river is at least 400 feet wide in most places, deep in the middle, with a ruthless current, and at this time of year, lethal temperatures. If you go under, you are gone. And if they find you, it is usually bobbing in a Boston boatyard weeks later, your skin and clothing torn to shreds. After attending to Melody Page, I am the kind of exhausted I used to think impossible. In my youth, when I first took to this profession, it was not uncommon for me to spend multiple days rushing from one berth to another. I could function on minimal sleep and sporadic meals. But something shifted once I turned 50. My body started rebelling at the inconsistent schedule. And now my entire physical being protests the long night. The combative conversations with Dr. Page and Mrs. Hendricks have left me drained. My neck is stiff and my eyes are dry. My bones feel loose at the joints, but my muscles tight. I am hungry. Home soon, I mutter,
as I traverse the midpoint of the river. It takes an effort not to hasten my steps, but I continue the careful, methodical passage until my right foot lands on firm ground. It is a short hike up the bank, and then I stomp my feet on the boardwalk, knocking the snow from the soles of my boots. The moon is bright and the clouds are wispy and low, making the sky look like an oyster shell, striated with shades of gray. I will be home in an hour if I am lucky, and then it's a cold dinner and my own bed. But first I must collect Brutus from where I left him stabled at the tavern. Though the residents of the Hook are comfortable walking back and forth across the river, few of us are brave enough to ride a 2,000-pound steed over the ice. I am turning toward Pollard's when I see that the lanterns are lit in Coleman's store. Odd. He usually closes shop by 6 o'clock. The front door is only a few steps away, so I go left instead of right and try the knob. It turns easily in my hand, and I step inside to the sound of bells tinkling merrily above my head. Samuel Coleman looks up from his place at the counter. "Who's there?" he asks, milky eyes squinting at me. "It's only Martha." "Ah," he says, "you're out late." "I've been at a berth across the river."
"And who's the new parent?"
I laugh at the absurdity. "Dr. Page."
"He called for you."
"He most certainly did not. And I can honestly say his is the first child I have ever delivered against my will. But all is well." "It is, no thanks to him."
"All's well that ends well, I suppose.
But that does not answer why you've brightened my doorstep this evening."
"I saw the lights were on."
"And you were worried about me?"
"Only curious. What has you up so late?"
Samuel Coleman lifts his ledger.
"This, going over it again, making sure I've gotten my accounts right. It gets harder every day."
On my way to the counter, I make sure there is no silver fox pelt among those for sale, as I have every time I've entered for the last few months. I breathe a sigh of relief upon finding nothing but rabbit, stoat, and beaver, the occasional raccoon, and the one red fox.
"Are ye looking for a skin, Mistress Ballard?"
"No, I'm looking to make sure one isn't here." When Coleman tips his head to the side in curiosity, I add, "There's a silver fox that roams our land. I think she's made a den under the old live oak down by the creek. To be honest, I've grown fond of her."
"A pelt like that would fetch a pretty penny. Traders from Russia and China in particular value them. A single one is worth $20, sometimes 30 if it's in good condition."
"But would you pay that?"
"I've never had the chance."
I lean closer. "But if one were offered, let's say by one of those trappers who come in on occasion, would you buy it?" He pulls at the corner of his mustache.
"Would it matter, since the wee beast would already be killed?"
"It would matter to me."
"Then I reckon the answer is no. But I get the impression that you dinna really want to talk about pelts."
"No, I had no reason other than curiosity for coming in. But now that I'm here, I thought I'd ask you about Sarah White."
"I barely know the girl."
"But do you dislike her?"
"Not at all."
"But would you dislike having her around?"
"I didn't want another wife, Mistress Ballard, and I'm too old for her besides."
I laugh long and loud. I cannot help myself. The thought hadn't even occurred to me.
"Gracious, no, that is not at all what I mean."
"Then explain what ye do, because I cannae fathom what it might be."
"You told me that you were looking to hire a shop boy, someone to work the counter and keep the books. I think Sarah would do well, and it would give your eye a break, not to mention the rest of you."
"You're saying I am old and feeble."
"You basically said so not 2 minutes ago."
I'm glad to see the flash of humor in that eye, the bobble at the corner of his mouth that suggests a smile he's trying to hide.
"You are nearing 70.
You have one eye and a grand total of 6 fingers spread between both hands. I am saying that having help in the shop a few days a week would be no great burden to you. I think you should consider Sarah.
That is an interesting suggestion, Mistress Ballard,
Coleman says. He leans across the counter and squints at me in such a way that his eye seems to disappear inside his face altogether. And I do wish ye'd brought it to me sooner.
Why is that?
Because just yesterday I accepted an offer on the store from a man in Boston.
You've sold it.
I will have next month when he arrives with payment.
I am sorry to hear this.
For more than one reason. I will miss Coleman, and I tell him so.
There's nothing to miss. I'll be staying on to help the man until he's up and running. You'll see me often enough.
Coleman winks, and it is both endearing and macabre. It makes me curious again how he lost the other eye. I have always feared that it would be an insult to ask, but I'm emboldened by my disappointment in losing this chance to help Sarah. What happened, I ask, to your eye, your fingers? I have always wondered.
You dinna take to the theory of piracy?
That's the rumor I've heard whispered almost around here, he says with a jolly rumble in his chest. And do you ken that no one has ever come out and asked me directly? You do cut an intimidating figure, I say.
Pfft, nonsense. Being scared and being scary are not the same thing.
I wait, not wanting to prod him any further in case it's an answer he does not want to give. But after a moment, he lifts his hand and turns it in the air, waves those stubby fingers.
It was during the Battle of Signal Hill. And wouldn't that be my luck? To get maimed in the last battle after being at war and unharmed for 7 years.
He looks at me, smiles. I still consider myself lucky. I just lost bits and pieces. Some men lost their lives, and others.
Well, Joseph North fought too, and he could tell you what it's like to lose a soul.
He says it so cavalierly, as though a soul is something you can lose as easily as a game of chess. What do you mean by that? There are great depths to that one milky eye, and I watch them settle over me as he ponders how to answer the question. When he finally speaks again, I worry he's lost the thread of our conversation.
She had beautiful hair, you know, he says.
Who?
My wife. It was bright, shiny, like a copper coin left in the sun. We'd been married 3 months when a Huron brave cut it from her head. I was told later that,
here he must clear his throat,
that it was sold to a Frenchman for 30 francs. They were going for headcount, see, proof of a dead English enemy.
This is the part no one talks about anymore, not in civilized company at least. When a war is over, you stop discussing the cost, the reality, the blood-soaked soil or the grave markers, or the collateral damage, the ways we kill our enemies in order to claim victory. History is written by the men who live, not the ones who die. But I've heard these stories myself. I know it isn't so easy as the French were bad and the English were good.
Ha, the English?
No, you'll never hear me defend their methods. My people came from those shores because they had no options left. The English weren't innocent of that either, I say.
No, they weren't. Much to their shame. But to them, the taking and selling of a human scalp was optional. Yet that option made Joseph North a very wealthy man. By the time war was officially declared in 1756, an Indian male scalp was worth 130 pounds to the English. A female, less. Always worth less, the women.
I cannot tell whether that last bit is an apology or an observation.
They fetched 50 pounds. And how do you think Joseph North built that fancy house on the hill? How do you think he hands out loans like candy?
Coleman asks and looks me dead in the eye.
Like I said, lost his soul.
Pollard's Tavern. Friday, March 26. Cyrus stands before the table and faces all three judges. Once again, the Court of Common Pleas has come to Hollowell, with the Honorable Obadiah Wood, James Parker, and John Hubbard presiding. As Judge North hasn't been seen by anyone in the Hook since the end of January, he was automatically removed from this hearing. Seth Parker stands beside Cyrus, ready to assist in this legal matter. He has assured us that the court has no legal grounds to keep our son imprisoned. But I have a bad feeling about these proceedings. Cyrus's case is the only one on the docket today. He has arrived freshly shaven and in his Sunday best. He looks more like his father than ever today, a man in his prime. But he's got a cheeky air about him that leaves me fidgeting in my seat. Cyrus looks like he's gunning for a fight.
"How do you plead?" Obadiah Wood asks Cyrus. "In the charge of murder against one Joshua Burgess in November of last year."
There is a stack of papers on the table beside him, and he bends over the pile, quill in hand, to write his response. "Not guilty." Once again, half the town is here. The tavern is packed. Beer and cider flow freely, but the room is silent. The accusation against him, though invalid, is one that most of the people here would consider just. No one is whispering today. Judge Parker leans across the table.
"As you have heard, there are seven men here who testify to the fact that you got into a physical altercation with the deceased on the night of November 25th. Do you deny having done so?"
"No."
Parker notes this in his ledger.
"What was the cause for your altercation?"
Cyrus takes his time writing out his response. After a moment, he shows the paper to Seth, who nods. But before he can hand it to the judge, Parker interrupts.
"In order to keep these proceedings expeditious, we will allow your attorney to read your answers, Mr. Ballard."
Cyrus hands the paper to Seth instead, who reads his answer aloud.
"Joshua Burgess put his hands on my sister. I defended her honor."
This, too, was verified by the judges earlier in the hearing, when seven different witnesses came forward to describe the events of November's frolic. But they want to hear from Hannah directly, so she goes to stand beside her brother.
"Please state your name for the court,"
Judge Parker says.
"Hannah Ballard."
"And what happened on the night in question?"
I can see Moses standing beside the fireplace next to Barnabas Lambert. His arms are crossed, and he scowls at the sight of her interrogation. He doesn't like her being put on display in this manner, and I can't say that I blame him. The boy is in love and protective, but Hannah insisted on defending her brother, as did Dolly, who, for her part, sits with a stiff back and lifted chin, doing all she can to ignore Barnabas. "Joshua Burgess asked me to dance all evening, and I refused him," Hannah says. "It wasn't just me, though. He went around the room several times, but never found a partner. But I was the last one to tell him no. So he got angry, grabbed my arm and dragged me onto the dance floor. He left bruises."
Moses was not aware of the bruises, I think,
and he takes a step forward, fists balled. Calmly, casually, Barnabas sets a hand on his shoulder and pulls him back, whispers something in his ear. "They've become friends, I think, and I am glad to see it."
"Is that when your brother came to your defense?"
Judge Wood asks. "Yes. It didn't take long. 5 or 10 seconds, maybe. And the fight didn't last much longer than that. Then Cyrus and a couple of other men tossed Burgess into the snow." Wood taps the table with one finger.
"Who were these other men?"
"Sam Dalwin and my brother Jonathan."
"Are they in the courtroom today?"
"They are." And they quickly confirm Hannah's testimony. Jonathan looks testy, and Sam uneasy. But the judges don't question them further.
The Ballard family has taken up an entire table and two benches at the tavern. Seth and Sam have joined us as well, and I like to think that the site is a bulwark for Cyrus.
Cyrus had nothing to do with Burgess's death, Hannah says. He stayed inside the remainder of the night, and then he took me and my sister home.
It's Judge Hubbard's turn to speak.
And what of your other brother?
Again, Jonathan stands.
After the dance, I left with Sam. We had an order of lumber to deliver. That was the night the river froze. We got locked in at Bumberhook Point.
That's where the body of Joshua Burgess was discovered.
Yes, sir. We were the ones who found him.
Hubbard looks to his colleagues, then directly at me.
Mistress Ballard.
I stand.
Yes.
You testified previously that your children returned home from the dance shortly before you were called to deliver a child?
Yes, roughly an hour or so.
And are you certain that Cyrus remained in bed after you left?
This talking in circles is exhausting, and it takes more effort than I would like to keep the frustration out of my voice. I have no reason to believe that he didn't.
And when the rest of your household woke later that morning, was he among them?
Young Ephraim, God bless his little lion's heart. The proceedings have been too much for him. He's scared for his older brother, and smart enough to know that the judges are looking for something, anything really, that will give them cause to proceed with a trial. He leaps to his feet and says, with a voice that cracks on the first word,
I can answer that.
At first, there was a titter of laughter behind us, and his cheeks blaze. But he stiffens his back and sticks out his chin.
Young man, your name?
Wood asks.
Ephraim Ballard the second,
he stammers. There's a smile at the corner of Wood's mouth, just a flicker of kindness.
Continue, please. Can you verify that Cyrus was home when the household awoke?
Yes. We share a room, and he was right there in bed when we were woken at 5. Sam Dalwyn fell through the ice, and it caused a big ruckus when he was brought to us. At first, we all thought he was dead.
This seems to be enough for Wood and Parker. Both of them lean back in their seats, nod, set down their quills. But Hubbard, it would seem, is feeling obstinate today, and is not so easily charmed by my youngest son.
And what of the 3 hours in between?
He asks.
Can you verify that your brother was home? 3 hours is plenty of time to sneak out and finish the job he'd started with Burgess.
I was asleep, young Ephraim says, as though it is the most obvious answer in the world. And so was Cyrus.
All this time, Seth has watched the proceedings. He's taken notes of his own in some scrawl that I can't read. But now he folds the paper in half, stands, and approaches the judge's table.
If I may speak, Your Honors.
It is his right as Cyrus's lawyer, and they allow it.
I move to have these charges dropped immediately. Nothing has been accomplished during this hearing, apart from dickering over the hours between 2 and 5 in the morning. It has been established that Cyrus Ballard did not go after Mr. Burgess that night. It has been established that he escorted his sisters home, went to sleep, and was there in his own bed when Sam Dalwyn was brought to the house. No witnesses have come forth saying otherwise, nor has the court produced a single shred of evidence tying him to the murder. Every judge on this bench has argued at least once that charges in the Foster case could not be brought because there was no witness to the actual crime. Yet here, in the case of murder, that same standard is not upheld. No, this hearing is not only a gross misuse of the judiciary, but a colossal waste of time. The court has no cause whatsoever to proceed beyond this point.
Somewhere at the back of the tavern, there is scattered clapping, and the judges retreat to the storeroom to deliberate. Friday, March 26. Cloudy and cold. The Court of Common Pleas convened at the Hook to consider the charges brought against Cyrus in the matter of Captain Burgess. They agreed that Cyrus should be released from the jail yard, but the charges remain pending. Pownal Borough Courthouse, Wednesday, March 31.
Let's go, Ephraim says. I'm hungry.
Our rented room is in the corner of the second floor and benefits from having three windows, two facing east and one north. There is a bed, desk, and washstand. It is spare but clean. The sun has made a rare appearance this morning, and I lean into the soft, warm light streaming through the windows. It likely won't last long, however. There are clouds on the horizon. I follow Ephraim out the door and down the stairs into the tavern, where the other guests have already collected. Like many public buildings in the colonies, the Pownal Borough Tavern serves multiple purposes. It is a three-story white clapboard building with a long addition attached to one side. The first floor is a tavern. The second comprises six rooms for rent. And the third is living quarters for the family of Samuel Goodwin, Kennebec proprietor, captain of the guard at Fort Shirley, and owner of this fine establishment. The addition, built 30 years ago, comprises a small jail and courthouse. Four of the other rooms have been rented by the judges who sit on the Supreme Judicial Court. They have traveled from Boston for Joseph North's trial. But unlike North and his colleagues in Vassalboro, they are all lawyers by trade. They all have private practices in the city. They are men of wealth and distinction. But to hear them mutter as they fill their plates at breakfast, none of them are pleased to be here. The judges typically make the trip only twice per year, once in December and once in July. But the severity of the Foster case has forced a special session of the court. Adding to the complication, however, is the Kennebec itself. Usually they sail from Boston to Bath, then upriver to Pownal Borough. But they were only able to get as far as Bath yesterday, then had to rent a carriage for the remainder of the journey. The frozen river alters every facet of life for those who live along it, yet the judges take the inconvenience as a personal slight. That is Robert Treat Payne, Ephraim whispers to me as we choose a table in the dining area. I am careful not to stare. The man is a legend in the colonies. One of 56 men to sign the Declaration of Independence, Payne is a lawyer, politician, judge, as well as a founding member of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. He has worked most of his life to outlaw slavery in what are now these United States. And while many believe it is a fool's errand, I am hopeful the cause will prevail. Is he fair? I ask. Will he listen to the facts of the case? Ephraim nods.
I am told his moral compass points straight north.
And the others?
The one with the dark hair, there to the left, is Nathan Cushing.
Ephraim tips his chin slightly to indicate the judge.
He was appointed to the bench by John Hancock in January. His brother, William, is one of the five justices on the United States Supreme Court.
He is no stranger to the law, then.
Indeed, it's a family legacy. The one next to him is Increase Sumner, as solid a jurist as can be found. He's been on the court for 8 years, also appointed by Hancock.
And the last?
Francis Dana, a delegate to the Continental Congress, signed the Articles of Confederation. I don't know a man who doesn't respect him.
All of them Harvard men?
Yes.
I sigh. I must admit to being weary of Harvard men just now. They've caused me nothing but trouble of late.
Well, I don't think Rebecca Foster could ask for a better set of jurists. They are nothing like the men who have heard the case thus far. If she has any chance of justice, it will be here.
I shift in my chair, then look at Ephraim with an expression of unmasked concern. Have you seen the Fosters yet?
No. The look he gives me is equally wary. They aren't staying here, or at least they haven't arrived yet. I paid extra to reserve the last room for them, but there are a dozen places in Pownal Borough they could be lodging.
I watch the judges at their table across the room. They look like mere mortals,
just men of varying ages at breakfast. In a few short hours, however, they will don their black silk robes and their powdered wigs and transform into symbols of power and authority. Those four men will determine whether justice is available to all or only a select few. Baths are a luxury. It has been several years since I enjoyed a long soak in a real copper tub. But I do now as we wait for the trial to begin. I'll pay extra for the privilege, since Captain Goodwin's children had to haul a dozen buckets of hot water upstairs to fill it. I don't care. It's worth every shilling to sit here and soak for an hour. I have soap, clean towels, and a quiet room where I can sort through my thoughts. I sit in the water until my fingers prune, until the water goes from hot to warm, from warm to cool. I sit here, wet hair dripping over the curved rim of the tub, listening to the hustle and bustle of a household I do not have to manage today. The running of this tavern is a family affair, much like it is for the Pollards, and I listen to the footsteps and muted conversations. The slamming of doors and the constant sound of children running up and down the stairs. Their laughter and happy bickering. Below me, above me, the sounds of life of a big family are everywhere. It is just the respite my nerves need. As the shadows shift and the water grows uncomfortably cold, I finally push myself out of the tub and step onto the mat. I towel myself off, then dress in the green silk gown that I paid Mrs. Densmore to make for me. It fits perfectly and has the shiny, stiff feel of a dress that's never been worn. Ephraim is waiting for me in the room when I return, and I can tell that he, too, is fortifying himself for the afternoon. His face is to the window, watching clouds the color of steel roll in, and he doesn't turn when I walk through the door.
They will hear four cases, Ephraim says. I just got word from the clerk downstairs. North's will be the last.
I thought this was the only one on the docket.
It was, until last week. There are three other cases of a... He pauses, considers his word choice. Carnal nature, that have been elevated from the lower courts. They thought it best to kill four birds with one stone, as it were, rather than wait until July. Perhaps they hope to get out of that trip altogether.
Ephraim finally turns around, looks at me, whistles long and low.
What? That is a new dress.
It is. He crosses the room, runs one finger just beneath the collar.
You look lovely in green.
I study a spot on the wall behind him. I thought that I should, that it matters, today, that I don't look like some country woman trying to make myself important. I struggle to explain. These are respected men, and they are deciding the fate of my friend. I want it.
Ephraim pulls me close, as he does every time that tears take me hostage.
I am not a weepy woman, but today does matter, and we have come a long distance to finally put this case behind us.
You look lovely, he says again, his voice a warm whisper curling into my ear. Now let us go find the Fosters.
The Supreme Judicial Court is hereby called to order, the court clerk announces to a full room. Please stand for the Honorable Justices Robert Treat Payne, Nathan Cushing, Increase Sumner, and Francis Dana.
6 dozen men and women stand when the four judges enter the courthouse. They look nothing like the men at breakfast this morning. Each wears his robe and his wig. 2 have donned spectacles. All appear distinguished and severe. There are no smiles, no nods of acknowledgement between one neighbor and another. Only solemnity and a near tangible sense of purpose. Despite all my years giving testimony, I have never been in a courtroom so serious as this. Ephraim insisted that we sit at the front this time, as close to the bench as possible, even though North's case will be the last called. Ephraim did confirm that North is in Palnoboro,
having made his first appearance since the disappearing act in Hollowell.
"Do you see the Fosters?" I ask.
30 minutes of inquiring up and down the main street of Pownoboro did not yield our friends, and a hard knot of worry has begun to grow in the pit of my stomach. Ephraim cranes his neck from one side to the other, looking for Isaac and Rebecca, then shakes his head.
"Not yet. I don't blame them for not wanting to sit through other people's misery as well as their own."
"What about Seth?"
"At the back of the room, keeping quiet and out of sight until the Foster's case is called."
"Good," I say, then turn to look at him. "That's a good sign."
As usual, Seth appears nondescript in his wool breeches and coat. Boring, but not shabby. He's shaved and trimmed his hair for the occasion, and I can see that all the buttons on his waistcoat have been polished. I try to catch his gaze, but he's watching something out the window.
Judge Nathan Cushing stands.
"As stated, and then later codified in the laws of this colony, on December 17th, 1623, all criminal acts and also matters of trespass and debts will be tried by the verdict of 12 honest men, impaneled by the authority of this court, to form a jury upon their oath," he tells the room. "Look to your left to see the men gathered today for this purpose."
The men sit, stone-faced, in two rows of six. They range in age from 20 to 80, some bearded, some shaven. They are local men, farmers, merchants, sailors, blacksmiths and carpenters. To the best of the court's knowledge, they have no relationship with any of the defendants. Cushing holds up his copy of the docket.
"Our first cause is an appeal, that of Hannah Barker, who was convicted by the Court of General Sessions of Lincoln County for slandering one Polly Noble, Miss Noble being a daughter of a justice of the peace on said court. All parties involved in these proceedings, come forward, please."
4 women and 1 man approach the long table where the judges sit.
"How do you plead, Miss Barker?"
Cushing asks. Hannah Barker is so thin she wouldn't leave prints if she walked across a muddy road. Nor is she pretty. Her face pocked and scarred from chin to hairline. But she stands straight and doesn't waver when she speaks.
"Not guilty. I ain't said nothing but the truth."
The truth, or at least Hannah's version of it, could have been stated a bit more politely, because when Cushing asks the 2 witnesses what Hannah told them about Polly, their answers are ruthless.
"God of heaven, that's what she said. Hannah, I mean," the first woman tells Cushing. "What do you think has happened to Noble's family? Polly has gone up to Boston and had herself a Negro bastard. She said it to me, just like that, last summer, coming out of church."
This last word is whispered, as though the real sacrilege was the location and not the accusation.
"And do you have any children, Miss Noble, illegitimate or otherwise?"
"No, sir."
"Have you ever been to Boston?"
"With my father, and he can testify that I never left his sight."
Cushing looks to the father, and he nods. Notes are made on the docket, and Cushing continues.
"Next witness."
A second woman steps forward. She bears such a resemblance to the first that I assume they are sisters.
"Hannah told me that Paul has been with several men, and that her father had even catched her under the counter once."
These accusations are also denied, and the father swears his daughter was up to no such behavior. Polly, when her turn comes to address the court, weeps and says her reputation has been ruined. She begs the jury to uphold the conviction. And they do. When Cushing hands the case over to the jury, they leave the room to deliberate alone in the tavern, but are gone less than 15 minutes. Cushing reads the verdict aloud.
"We, the jury, find Hannah Barker guilty of slander."
Cushing makes his note on the docket, then adds, "This court sustains the previous conviction and fines Miss Barker the sum of $75. More wailing, but from Hannah Barker this time.
It is a fee large enough to financially destroy Miss Barker and her family. I look over my shoulder, searching for the Fosters. I fear Rebecca will take the judgment to mean that the justices will show partiality to North. For once, I am relieved not to see her. Increase Sumner bangs his gavel on the table this time, calling the court back to order, then stands to announce the next cause to be presented.
The court will hear the cause of Thomas Maloney, who is charged with living in sin with his own sister, Johanna, and murdering the infant born of her body. Please bring forth all witnesses, Judge Sumner says, then takes his seat once more.
Instead of Johanna, two men come forward, one from the back of the room and the other through a side door from the jail. Father and son, if I have ever seen a pair. One old and bent, the other stiff and defiant. Neither of them has acquired a lawyer.
Not guilty, Thomas Maloney says when asked.
His father, however, tells a different tale.
They is brother and sister, and they has lived in one house together ever since Johanna had her first child. Three of them she has now. But I don't know who is the father of them children.
Neither the act of incest nor the murder of an infant can be confirmed by the court, as there are no witnesses who saw either take place. All that can be confirmed is that brother and sister live under the same roof, and that Johanna has a habit of bringing illegitimate children into the world. This causes some consternation between the judges, because it is obvious the law has been violated and a child is dead. But without Johanna or her testimony, the case is sent to the jury on speculation alone. 10 minutes later, Sumner reads the verdict.
We, the jury, vote to acquit Thomas Maloney on charges of incest and murder due to lack of evidence.
I stiffen in my seat, and Ephraim reaches for my hand. He squeezes it just hard enough to make me hiss.
Careful, he whispers.
What? I haven't said anything.
You were about to.
Only that a woman gossips, I mutter in his ear, and is fined enough money to buy 3 horses, but a man breaks laws, both divine and human, and walks out of court with his hands in his pockets.
Would you have them hang him from a tree without a stitch of evidence? Not a single witness came forward to support the accusation.
And nary a single concern that Johanna's men stood in court without her.
Ephraim squeezes my hand again, but harder this time. How many worries would you have me carry today, love? Those of a stranger as well?
It's a fair question, but I cannot help but feel unsettled that a young woman is out there in the world with no one to protect her from those closest to her. My only comfort is that Sumner looks equally disturbed as he makes notes on his copy of the docket. The third case called before the judges is of great interest to me, and once again I search the courtroom for signs of the Fosters. Still nothing. They are cutting it awfully close. Judge Francis Dana takes his turn to address the room.
The court will hear an appeal from Nathaniel Whittaker, convicted by the Court of Common Pleas of Lincoln County, of the attempted rape of one Millie Lambert.
No relation to Barnabas, I hope,
Ephraim mutters. The courtroom listens as Millie Lambert states that 4 years earlier, Nathaniel Whittaker assaulted her in a field in Canaan. He denies this emphatically. Her family testifies that she told them about the assault on the morning that it happened. His family testifies that it couldn't have happened because he was with them, it being a Sunday afternoon, and they all supped together after services. Questions are asked, accusations made, but in the end, this case also goes to the jury without a preponderance of evidence. The earlier conviction is overturned, and Nathaniel Whittaker walks out triumphant.
Where are you going? Ephraim asks.
Privy, we've been sitting here for hours.
They're about to start.
Better now than later and miss my chance to testify. I weave my way through the crowd. Most of the people standing to stretch or gossip about what they've heard,
and step into the bracing air. Fine little puffs of snow drift down from the steely clouds that hover above Pownoboro, and I glare at the sky. I am tired of winter, of snow, of ice, of cold. I am tired of the world being held in suspension between these mercurial seasons. But I do not control the four winds, cannot command the sun to burn hot again. I can, however, empty my bladder and make myself a bit more comfortable. The line to the privy is long, at least 20 people deep, and I shift from foot to foot. The human need for relief is impolite and inconvenient, but really the tavern should have more than one accommodation for such needs. 5 minutes. 10. 15. I glance over my shoulder as the sound of a gavel banging the table resonates through the chill air. Only two more people in front of me. By the time I close the outhouse door and throw up my skirts, my relief is replaced by fear, and I do my business as quickly as possible. By the time I make it back to the courthouse, half the room is standing. People crane their necks, whisper. There is a buzz in the air, like static. It makes me tense, makes me feel as if an itch is snaking its way across my body.
"What took you so long?" Ephraim asks when I squeeze back to the front of the room.
"Them," I indicate those around us. "The line was long."
"Well, they called north."
I see him. He stands off to the side, head bent, whispering with a man I have never seen before. Ephraim sets his hand to the small of my back. He means to calm me, but the gesture has the opposite effect.
"They also called the Fosters. They aren't here."
"That can't be."
"5 minutes, Martha. They haven't come forward. I've even looked outside. They aren't here. And Seth hasn't seen them either."
"But..."
Judge Robert Treat Payne does his best to call the room to order. He bangs his gavel again. Slowly, the room settles. People take their seats.
"This is the last call for Rebecca Foster," Payne says.
Seth makes his way to the front of the room.
"Are you Mr. Foster?"
He shakes his head.
"No. My name is Seth Parker, the attorney representing the Fosters. Are your clients here today?"
He clears his throat uncomfortably.
"I do not know. But I am prepared to argue their cause regardless. And they also have a witness present who has traveled from Hollowell to testify on their behalf."
He points to me.
"It seems that you take these proceedings a great deal more seriously than your clients, Mr. Parker. Please excuse Rebecca, Your Honor. She is 8 months pregnant as a result of the assault."
"Alleged assault." The man standing beside North steps forward and introduces himself. He is tall and smug and wears a fine dark coat.
"Henry Noland, Esquire, attorney for the defense."
He approaches the table and hands Payne a small square calling card.
"I traveled here from Boston with my client."
"Well, at least Lydia didn't lie about where he went," I whisper to Ephraim. Payne nods.
"Thank you. As Mr. Parker was saying,"
he glares at Henry Noland.
"Regardless of how you define the assault, the fact remains that my client is 8 months pregnant as a result. No doubt why she is not present today, Your Honor. Travel of any kind at this time would prove to be a burden. Yet this circumstance should not prevent this court from moving forward with the trial. I am prepared to argue on her behalf. I have brought depositions, and her witness has evidence as well."
"Bring the depositions forward," Payne says. Seth hands both recorded testimonies to Judge Payne, then returns to his place at the front of the room. He reads both accounts aloud for the benefit of the courtroom. No one shifts or speaks until he's done.
"Mistress Ballard," Payne asks, and I stand. "Do you confirm that this was written by your hand, and that all of the details are true?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
"And have you brought this journal mentioned in your deposition?"
"I have."
"Please, bring it forward."
I lay my book on the table in front of the judges and flip to the pages mentioned in my deposition.
"I would like the jury to note
that everything is in accordance with her written account. Thank you, Mistress Ballard. You may be seated.
Ephraim takes my hand, rubs the base of my thumb with his. The whisk-whisk of his calloused finger on my skin is comforting, grounding.
We will move on to the cause between the Commonwealth and Joseph North, Judge Payne says. He reads the charges aloud for the benefit of the court. It is stated that on the night of August 10th, Joseph North broke into the house of Isaac Foster and made an attempt to ravish his wife despite her many attempts to exert herself against him. She on oath affirmed this at two prior hearings in Kennebec County and has deposed the same. How do you plead, Colonel North?
North looks distinguished this afternoon. Hair and beard have both been trimmed. His suit is new, shoes polished. He comes to stand before the table with his attorney.
I plead not guilty, Your Honor. Then what have you to say regarding these accusations?
Henry Nolan takes over for his client. It is a wise move given how North tends to argue and interrupt when not in command of a courtroom himself.
Depositions notwithstanding, accusations notwithstanding, there are no witnesses who can attest that these things did in fact happen as claimed. No one saw my client coming or going at the Fosters that evening. No one saw any crimes perpetrated upon her person that evening. Her only witness is a midwife who tended to her 9 days later, who herself is taking Mrs. Foster's word about these events. Was she hurt in some fashion? No doubt. Is there any proof whatsoever that my client is responsible? None. We have only the word of a woman who did not even bother to show up today to testify on her own behalf. How seriously can she truly take this fabrication? Gentlemen, he implores, turning to the jury and addressing them directly. Come, be reasonable. Will you ruin the life of a good man, a respected man, an upstanding member of a fine community? A man who has served this country honorably in not one but two wars. A colonel, a judge, all on account of rumors and speculations. You are smarter than that, and you are far more honorable.
Nolan returns to his place, and Judge Payne motions for Seth to take the floor.
Mr. Parker, do you have any additional words for the court?
Seth looks around the courtroom, searching for the Fosters one last time, and I wince at the desperation in his eyes. Finally, he takes a deep breath and turns to the jury.
How is it honorable to ignore the undisputed facts that a woman was raped and is now pregnant as a result? No one denies that. They only question her word, her account. They shout witness, as though crimes such as this are ever performed in broad daylight, in the middle of a street. Evil is always done in secret. You know that. Rebecca Foster is a witness, and her account should not be discounted simply because a late pregnancy, one that was forced upon her, has made it impossible for her to travel. She has asked this court to render justice. The real question is whether you will deny her that justice. There is no reason whatsoever to doubt her claims. The defense certainly has not provided any. The truth has been clearly presented, and you must act upon it as the good men, the honorable men that you are.
Seth Parker returns to his seat, jaw clenched in fury, and does not make eye contact with anyone.
The court gives this matter over to the jury for deliberation.
Robert Treat Payne thumps the table once with his gavel, then leans back in his chair. We do not leave the courtroom. Most of those gathered here do not feel the same sense of urgency, however,
and they wander out to stretch their legs when the jury retreats to deliberate. The judges slip away as well to make the most of this break. The first 30 minutes isn't bad, but when the time crawls toward an hour, I start to get tense. Sensing my mood, Ephraim grabs my hand and stops chattering about the weather and what we'll plant in the spring. Seth Parker remains as well, but across the room, deep in the throes of a good and angry sulk. There are only 10 people left in the courtroom when the 12 men deciding Rebecca's case return. There is a mad scramble outside when word spreads, and it takes another 5 minutes before everyone has taken their seats. The jury foreman hands the slip of paper to Judge Francis Dana. He unfolds it, reads the words carefully, not once, but twice. Then he hands it to Increase Sumner on his left. I scrutinize their faces for any indication of how the jury has ruled. Nothing. There is not a single clue written on their faces. Increase Sumner hands the paper to Nathan Cushing. He reads, and his eyes are inscrutable. He passes the paper to Robert Treat Payne. Once again, the man gives not even the barest glimpse of emotion as he takes in the jury's verdict. There is nary a scowl, a sigh, no lifted eyebrow or deep inhale. Payne leans across the table and hands the slip of paper back to Sumner. He pushes his spectacles onto the bridge of his nose. "We, the jury," he reads, voice certain and clear, "declare the defendant, one Colonel Joseph North, acquitted on the charge of attempted rape as it concerns one Mistress Rebecca Foster."